And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I had a chance this week to sit down with one of my favorite people, David Chalian, the political director of CNN, and the host of his own podcast, the CNN Political Briefing. David's one of the smartest political journalists around, but as you'll hear, he also has an incredibly interesting personal story. Here's that conversation. David Chalian, first of all, let me say happy birthday.
Thanks.
It's serendipity that I should be here with you on this auspicious day.
I can't think of another way I'd like to celebrate my 49th birthday.
That's a sad commentary.
Right? No, I'm happy to spend time with you.
We're starting off lying to each other.
Not true.
No, but it's really great to see you. And, you know, one of the great blessings of this show is that you end up learning about people who you thought you knew well. And, you know, I didn't know a lot about your personal history. So let's start there.
Okay.
And your family, Armenian Jews.
Yeah, which is an odd combination. Well, two sides of the family. My father, the Armenian side, grew up Catholic. He converted to Judaism to marry my mom.
Ah.
And so, but basically genocide and persecution on all sides, right?
Yes. And did his family come over around the time of the genocide or?
No, his family came over a little past that. But he and my mother both grew up in Brooklyn, and they were sort of on the streets of Brooklyn together in their middle school years. They didn't sort of fall in love until college years, but they were very good friends. And so my father, I was telling this story about, he converted to Judaism to marry my mom because he knew how important it was to my mom's dad,
yes,
my grandfather, that happened. And again, they were childhood friends. So when my dad went to his father to say, hey, I'm going to convert to Judaism and do this to make things easier. My grandfather, who I didn't know, he died before I was born on my father's side, who really liked my mom, knew her as my dad's good friend, just had one line to say. And he said, as long as you know you're going to hell for it. And then that was it. Like, went to the wedding, attended. It was a totally accepted thing, but I guess needed to get that off his chest. I can assure you, my father, who passed away at age 43 when I was 11 years old, did not go to hell for it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. That's hard. I lost my dad when I was 19, but 11 years old is very young.
Yeah. And I'm realizing now, David, in my age, that 43 is really young, too.
I celebrating my 49th birthday. About it. It's just...
And so I think about... Like, I'm what, on what borrowed happened? Time. He had a heart attack. He woke up one morning and just had a heart attack. And
were you there
died.
When that happened?
I was in my bedroom. My dad woke up, collapsed, and I didn't go into my parents' room. We had a neighbor across the street who worked on the first aid squad, was a volunteer member on the first aid squad, came over, tried to revive him. The ambulance came, took him, and then we just... I stayed at the house with my sister and my grandmother who had come over and waited for my mom to come back from the hospital with the news that he didn't make it. So it was, devastating. I was 11. My sister was 14. My mom was 42. As I said, my dad was 43. And it was a life-altering event for our family.
And you were close to your dad?
Yeah, very. I mean, I think, again, now it's like... close to my dad. I was 11 years old, so super close. We were a close-knit family.
Yes.
But think about all that time that I could have been getting closer to him and didn't have that.
No, I, you know, like I said, I lost my dad at 19, and it was
under
tragic.
Very
yes,
circumstances.
He took his own life. But I had him for those formative years, you know, and he helped steer me through. In fact, the last conversation we had was rich with meaning that I didn't understand at the time. He called me at college and said, you know, I know now that you and your sister are going to do very well, and I just want you to know how proud I am of you. It was unusual to get a call like that. And yeah. I was like, well, thanks, Dad. You know, I appreciate that. And I didn't realize he was saying goodbye.
Yeah. Well, but my father, again, it was a surprise. He couldn't say goodbye, but I never doubted for a day in the 11 years I had with him that he was proud of me. I look like him, so I get to sort of see him in the mirror each morning. And he remained a very living presence in our lives. My mother got remarried. My stepfather, Lloyd, is a great guy and has been a part of our family for decades now. But my mom made sure that my dad remained a living presence. No photos of my dad came down in the house. Lloyd came into our house and in a very loving way accepted the fact that our father was still going to be a presence in our lives, and just new photos went up. But that was really important to my mom. And I, my mother, a saint. I mean, you know, she always says having an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old helped her get through this tragedy yeah. because she had to get up every day and continue to raise right. her kids. And that was her saving grace. And she clearly was our saving grace.
Yeah. You had two interests that grew up sort of side by side. One was in politics and the other was in theater, which weirdly are somewhat related, I can say, having spent my life around politics.
Yeah.
But talk to me about that.
So it's funny to hear you say that, David, because, of course, in your line of work throughout your whole career, you sort of have lived at this intersection of politics and performance and, yeah. And all of that.
And as a journalist, I covered the theater of politics.
Exactly. When I told people initially when I went to school at Northwestern University, and I, when I initially got to school and double majored in theater and political science, people used to look at me like I had two heads. Like, how did those two things go together? And as you noted, nobody looks at me that way anymore.
Right.
The theater of politics, I think, is so present in our everyday that it doesn't seem as crazy. You are right. They were dual passions of mine. When I was in the first grade, my first grade teacher, Mary Lynch was her name, Miss Lynch. She challenged us to go home and learn the name of the president of the United States and the two presidents preceding him.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home and I opened up the World Book Encyclopedia in our house and went to
memorize them all.
Yeah,
I knew you were going to.
In reverse chronological order,
yes,
right? So
yes.
and I couldn't stop learning their names and who these men were. And I went into school the next day and I recited all of the presidents in reverse order, and I would tug on the janitor's leg and recite it. And so my fascination with presidential politics was very early on, and I've always had a love of American history. But
let me just say parenthetically, now that you're approaching your 50th year, you're going to find yourself reciting the presidents in reverse chronological order just to test your mental acuity.
Exactly. And I'll have to actually add the ones after Jimmy Carter, who was president when I was in first grade, because I memorized it by rote then, I'm sure.
But anyway, this was a passion of yours. But how did the theater...
And that was developing at the same time. I mean, you know, school plays and what have you. I loved this notion of being on stage and performing and getting a response from the audience. And that was really the passion, the hobby that became the dominant force in my life in middle school and high school. I was immersed in school theater projects, in community theater projects in the town in New Jersey that I grew up in. And I really thought I wanted to be a Broadway actor and that I wanted to pursue this in college and as a profession. And so I thought, well, I want to keep the politics thing and I'll study that, but I think I'm going to go into theater.
And, you know, I had this interesting podcast with Tom Hanks, who had a very troubled childhood. I mean, people think of him as sort of the all-American guy, but he really, you know, he lived in 10 different places. His family was sort of dysfunctional and so on. And he said he found in theater, he found his community. And did you find community in theater?
Without a doubt. And at each stage of my youth, where I saw how other communities were being formed around sports teams or around fraternities in college, my community was the theater. And there's no doubt about it. It became... It became the thing that formed my friends. It became the thing that formed my identity. And to this day, I mean, I don't obviously don't work in the theater, but I love very much going to the theater and being around people and friends and colleagues who do work in the theater. I think it's a fantastic community.
Northwestern University has a wonderful theater program, and I'm sure that's what drew you there. You didn't leave. You left Northwestern, and you did go to try and pursue a career in theater at first.
I did, and you are right. It was the theater program at Northwestern that drew me to that school. Somebody, when I was in eighth grade, said, Northwestern has one of the best theater programs in the country, but you get a broad-based liberal arts education. And I just set my sights on, like, that's where I want to go.
Yeah.
Best decision I ever made in my life.
It's a great,
hands down, great
university.
Great university. And just...
it's not the University of Chicago, but it's great.
I knew you would say. But but I do... it just sort of changed. It broadened my mind. It changed me intellectually. And it was... And I've, to this day, my very best friends in life are my college friends. And yes, I left to pursue acting knowing
that. Did you do journalism there at all?
So I didn't. And it's so funny because, of course,
Medill is a great journalism school.
World-renowned journalism school. When people hear I went to Northwestern and they know that I'm a journalist now, they assume I went to Medill. And no, I didn't. I mean, I read the Daily Northwestern, the newspaper there, and it was not a pursuit of mine at all. I was really focused on theater and, like I said, on my political science classes, but not the piece of journalism. And that came shortly after. So I did leave college and I was doing like black box off Broadway stuff. First starting in Chicago. I lived in Chicago for a year after school and then moved to New York, did some commercial or what they call industrial work, like doing videos of like employee training videos or what have you that people get cast in. But none of this daily grind of like going to an audition, rejection, going to an audition, rejection.
Yeah.
I was like, plus I'm working temp jobs to, you know, actually pay my rent and live my life. And so I was just like, there must be something more fulfilling than this as a day-to-day existence.
Although you fell in with a noted figure in theater, Anna Deavere Smith, who, a playwright, a performer. People may remember her from The West Wing, where she played the national security advisor. But she's a really, really accomplished stage actor.
Very much so. I mean, she basically created the genre of documentary style theater as a in one person shows, right? She's sort of the creator of that, and she had done work that I studied in my theater classes, Fires in the Mirror about the Jews and the Blacks in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, or Twilight Los Angeles, her work about the LA riots after the Rodney King decision came down. And I was out of school 2 years at this point, David, and I saw in the New York Times that Anna Deavere Smith was working on a new project all about Washington and the relationship between the press and the presidency. And I had written my poli-sci thesis in college on the relationship between the press and the presidency, and here's this woman who I had studied in my theater classes, and I was like, I would sweep floors to go work on this project.
So you grabbed a broom and went on over?
I was like, well, how am I going to find this and track it? And I didn't do anything about it. And 2 months later, after seeing that little preview in the New York Times, I got a call from one of my best friends from college. She said, I was just offered an internship at Arena Stage for this new Anna Deavere Smith project, but I can't take it. I'm on my way out of the country.
Wow.
And I thought you'd be perfect for it. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Is this the same? And I went to meet with Anna. And then I ended up working with Anna for 3 years on a whole host of projects. She was writing a book. I did some research. I did some producing. I helped her prepare for interviews for this play about the press and the presidency. She would interview people like you. She was interviewing all sort of the Clinton White House aides and journalists in Washington.
Probably helped
at the time.
Her later when she did The West Wing.
Yeah, exactly. And she would bring these hour-long interviews back, and I would go through it and the transcript, and we'd figure out which pieces would work for the play. And, you know, as we were working on that project and I heard all of these journalists, national political journalists, sharing their stories with her while I was doing this play, and it just started resonating with me, being like, wow, maybe that is something I can do.
It's an interesting parable because if there are younger people listening to this podcast, you know, it's like you can make a 30-year plan for life, but it's never going to work out exactly as you think, and better to follow those leads and passions if you can. I mean, you had to make a living. I don't know when in that sequence of events that you played Superman in a local TV ad. I read somewhere that you did that.
That was in my first year out of college. Where I don't know where you read that. I don't know that that was ever in the public domain. But
it is now.
I did have to put on a Superman costume for one of those industrials.
We're still seeking photos of this. We thought
I can assure you there are none.
But then you went over to New York One.
Yeah.
Which is a local cable station in New York City. They do a lot of politics, covered City Hall intensively. Mm-hmm. Mayor at the time was Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, it was his final year of his mayoralty that I started there. And I was attached to the political unit because of my interest in politics. And it was following Giuliani's final year, but also the beginning of this amazing 2001 mail race, David, and this is actually where I met you for the very first time. And you won't recall this, but I do. You were sitting in the green room at New York One because you were advising Fernando Ferrer's mayoral campaign in that Democratic primary that year. And, you know, we had on the consultants and the strategists all the time on our nightly political show in New York One called Inside City Hall. And I think we switched the title in election years to The Road to the City Hall.
Yes.
And you were a guest on that. And I remember meeting you in the green room, and I was brand new to this business. I was a news assistant. And I just got my eyes opened on the campaign trail to being in front of these candidates seeking high office every day and being part of this operation that got to sort of test them and prod them and observe them and contextualize what they're saying, what they're selling to the citizenry. And my hunch in listening to those stories that Anna Deavere Smith was collecting in her work proved quickly that it was right, that this was a good fit. And back to your earlier question about sort of politics and theater and where do they come together? Journalism and theater come together in one very clear way, and it's storytelling.
Yes.
It's all storytelling.
Yes, 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 yes.
And so that became the common thread for me that it took a while to understand, but that I understood all that theater training actually was very applicable because of the training and storytelling to journalism.
Yeah, no, it's such a good point. It's what attracted me. That element of politics is what attracted me. In fact, we tried to tell a counter narrative in that 2001 campaign in New York because every other candidate was trying to be the next Rudy Giuliani. And we ran against that whole idea that what New York needed was a continuation of Giuliani. Freddie Ferrer would have won that race, but for the fact that a couple of airplanes hit the World Trade Center's center towers on election
on
day.
On primary day, yep.
Yeah, it was what a.
And so then that obviously became a story, 9/11, that obviously dominated everywhere. But for New York One, the local channel, it was everything. And so in that first year as a journalist, I got to cover this mammoth story.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. Then you had sort of this meteoric rise at ABC. You worked for Mark Halperin there, who at that time was really one of the most highly regarded political journalists in the country. You must have some thoughts about, I mean, Mark had a meteoric fall.
Yeah. I mean, he is a mentor of mine and has been instrumental in my career. He recruited me over to ABC from New York One to join the political unit. It's obviously very hard to sort of square your personal feelings for someone when you then see them dealing with this onslaught of allegations that
sexual assault, harassment.
Yeah,
and so
he
on.
Was like a high profile Me Too.
Yeah.
Sort of story shortly after Harvey Weinstein. I think it was, you know,
yeah, well, he was one of those pictures on the screen.
And that was, you know, devastating because of what high regard I held him in. And then you have to sort of sort out how do you have love for someone who has done something wrong? And you know, that takes some time to sort through.
Yeah, yeah. When he left ABC, this was not for that reason. That came much later. You became the political director at ABC, which is quite something. I mean, it wasn't that long after you had sort of made the conversion from theater to journalism.
Yeah, no. I mean, I had been a journalist for 6 years, I guess, at that point, between New York One and my early days at ABC, and had been promoted to ABC News political director just at the very early stages of, you know better than anyone, one of the greatest political stories ever in terms of presidential politics. That 2008 race on both the Republican and Democratic sides was just extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... I enjoyed it.
I bet you did.
Yes. And I think we had a lot of dealings.
We did.
We had a lot of dealings then. You traveled to Alaska and produced the first television interview with Sarah Palin when she was appointed McCain's running mate.
Yeah. So before the now infamous Katie Couric interview with Sarah Palin, Charlie Gibson got the first network interview with Sarah Palin.
Which was also pretty revealing.
It was very revealing. And I will tell you, that experience was incredible. I'd never been to Alaska, so that also was incredible. But we spent 2 days with Governor Palin, and this was a week after her acceptance speech at the convention. So she was brand new to this,
and riding pretty high,
and running pretty hot, no doubt. And we did the first day of interviews up in Fairbanks. Her son was being deployed to Iraq, I believe. And she was there for the departure ceremony. And then Charlie sat with her. And
which, by the way, is pretty smart political stagecraft to have you guys come up for that.
Yeah, no doubt. And so Charlie sat with her. And this is where, if you remember, Charlie Gibson had sort of asked her about her thoughts on the Bush Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And her answer, I just remember... I'm sitting there as one of the producers off camera taking notes so we can identify what are the newsiest bits of the interview. And I looked down at my notebook and I had written almost nothing down. Like I couldn't find what her actual answer was to her thoughts on that. And I thought, well, that's intriguing. I wonder if she's nervous or is she, you know, or is she revealing something to us here that maybe she's not ready for this job that John McCain has asked her to do? And then I think, you know, that answer became clear to the country as the campaign went on. The next day, I will tell you, the second day of interviews, we went to her house in Wasilla. And this is when I realized she was going to hook into and capture the imagination of a big swath of Americans.
Yes.
This is such a silly little thing that stuck in my head, but it's a suburban home, a nice suburban home, and we were walking in through the garage into the laundry room, and all of her and her family's credentials from the Republican convention the week before, the lanyards that we all wear around our neck to get on the floor of the convention, they're like hanging on the coat hook in the laundry room, which is where I hang my credentials, like on a coat hook in my apartment or in my house at the time. And so I just, in that moment, I thought, if I had walked into the Obama house, the McCain house, or the Biden house, would those be hanging on a coat hook, or will someone have already sort of like
such
put those away somewhere? And it was just this moment where it was like, and then she was calling after the kids. We sat down for the interview. She wanted to see the shot. She said, because it was, we were shooting her and you could see her kitchen beyond her, even though she was in the living room. She wanted to make sure the dirty dishes weren't washed yet were out of the frame of the shot. And in that moment, I was just like, oh, she is identifiable to so many people. I could see her really having some traction on the trail.
Yeah, it was a whole hockey mom
thing.
You were so right in ways that you probably didn't even imagine. You know, if you trace sort of the kind of foundation of Trumpism, you saw it in the crowds that she attracted in that campaign. I mean, there was something, you know, that there was a foreshadowing there. That and what she began, you know, she was disdained at the time by other, you know, more refined Republicans. Her wing of the party, whether she's propelled by it or not, she's running for Congress now. Her wing of the party is the dominant wing of the Republican Party.
Without a doubt. And just to use the example you're citing of her, the sort of foundations of Trumpism, I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, I think we saw it, you know, all at the same time. Do you remember this was when the House Republicans failed to pass TARP?
The bill to save Wall Street after the housing collapse, the mortgage collapse in 2008.
And it was a Republican president, yeah. Right? And a Republican Treasury
right.
Secretary. And yet the Republicans divided amongst themselves.
Between the corporate Republicans and the populist
Republicans. And down the bill. And that to me was like and then Palin was right in that moment. And then, of course, with Obama's ascendancy to the presidency and the Tea Party came shortly thereafter, this all grew into Trumpism. But to your point about the 08 campaign, remember that moment with John McCain?
Yes.
When that woman,
in
I
Minnesota.
Think he was in Minnesota. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. And she was claiming that Obama was a Muslim and
right.
Falsely, obviously. And McCain, in that moment, did something the Republican Party hasn't done with
right.
Trumpism
yes.
overall, which is to say no.
It was his finest moment, and it was his most McCain moment in that campaign. And he got booed
right.
for doing it when he
you can
defended
see
Obama.
Which piece of the party was ascendant
yeah,
in that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You went to PBS for a couple of years,
which was
directing
amazing.
Their political coverage. And then you left and you went to Yahoo News,
mm-hmm.
which was going to make a big play at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But in a very, very kind of illustrious career, this was your trial.
Yeah.
This was your moment. You were, I assume you thought you were not on a hot mic. And
right.
you made a comment. Just if you don't mind, and it's a bad thing to ask someone on their birthday, but.
That's okay. I was fired from Yahoo for making a comment that was caught on a hot mic on what was the first canceled night of the Republican convention
in Tampa, due to a storm in
2012. What I did was I talked, and this was such an important lesson to learn in life. I wouldn't want to have to learn it this way and be publicly humiliated. But when you talk crassly about political optics, as you would maybe off the record at a bar, and again, I was on a hot mic. This was not intended for air, but I was talking in pure, crass, political optics
mm-hmm.
terms. And that just got construed when it got out there as something other than that I was making like a
It was a comment that essentially the Romneys want to go on with their party despite the fact that dead black people were floating in hurricane I forget which hurricane it was in Louisiana.
Because of a whole series of events, I was actually referring. I didn't believe I said the Romneys by name. I was referring like Republicans wouldn't want to hold their party while this is happening. That they the campaign and what have you, but
I probably made it worse than it was about the Romneys
and. As I said, Yahoo fired me for this in the moment. I apologized publicly to the Romneys but it was a real lesson in learning about just how misconstrued dumb words can be. And I was dumb to just talk so crassly about a political observation when people's lives were at stake and a campaign was in play. So,
yeah. First of all, let me say I remember it because everybody in politics has such a high regard for you. And I think everyone in politics understood this as a kind of careless episode. But, you know, I think uniformly everyone felt terrible about it, but no more than you, I'm sure. The reason I ask you is, how do you deal with that? A very public sort of repudiation, as you say, humiliation. After building such a great, having such this meteoric career, as I mentioned, and building such a great reputation in the business. I mean, how devastating was it?
It was really devastating. I mean, I described it second only to my father's death as like as devastating kind of an event for me. Thank God I had family and friends who immediately came around. And to your point, I heard, I mean, I remember getting a message from you in the hours after that, reaching out. I heard from every corner, Republicans, Democrats that I had covered forever, my fellow journalists, there was a real support in the community that I was sort of just excommunicated from. You know, in the immediate aftermath, it was like, how do I get out of the convention center and get to my hotel and get on a plane and get back? And there was all of that. And you just feel like the eyes of the world are on you. I got incredible advice from Sam Donaldson, who was my colleague at ABC. And he said, you know, you think you're going into Starbucks to order your coffee and the barista is only thinking about the fact that you were just fired, and they are not. They are thinking about their lives, and it'll just take a little time to realize that. And I think that was true. I think it created this momentary maelstrom, and the only way I was able to sort of push through it was a belief that what you said is true, that I had built up enough of a reputation as a solid, well-respected political journalist that reputation would survive this moment. I didn't know that, though. I didn't trust that. But that is indeed what ended up happening, again, with a lot of love and support from family and friends.
Yeah, every single one of us. I mean, some of these stories aren't as public, but, you know, life is not a straight line.
And, no.
But some of these lessons are really painful. So you went to Politico, and then for a couple of years, and then you wound up here at CNN. And I don't want to go through the whole history of, we can talk about elections. You and I could burn a lot of time talking about
we have over the years. Yes.
Yes. But I want to talk about 2016. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about how CNN covered Donald Trump as a primary candidate, gave him a lot of time because his rallies were shtick. Mm-hmm. They drew eyeballs and so on. And talk to me about that and sort of the decision making that and the discussions that were had back then and what lessons were drawn from that.
Yeah, well, I think our former colleague and boss here, Jeff Zucker,
yes,
at the time, has said this many times, and I totally agree with it. One of the big lessons learned, and we learned it pretty quickly, was you were talking about the rallies, that after that first summer, that Trump phenomenon was happening in the summer of 2015, and we were trying to figure out what it was, and it was this draw, and it was almost nothing. We hadn't seen anything sort of in American politics quite like what was happening, that we would take his full rallies. And by September, October of that year, long before the voters in the Republican nomination contest started voting, we stopped doing that. And I think that, as Jeff said at the time, was an important lesson to learn, to not just take sort of unedited the full Trump rally.
One of the things that made it, I mean, Jeff was looking at it as a television guy, and it was interesting television. One of the things that made it interesting was Trump would say things that no other politician had the temerity to say, and that turned out to be kind of essential to his appeal, that his willingness to basically give the big middle finger to all political conventions, to say things that others wouldn't say, legitimated him with the people who ultimately supported him.
Yeah, and you know, I just think we quickly turned our coverage, in addition to just covering the outlandish things he would say, as you said, and have the temerity to say where others wouldn't, which was a story in and of itself. But then that did quickly turn to, so why is this appealing for a significant swath of the Republican electorate? Because he was gaining a ton of traction, and he was clearly on the rise. I mean, by the time we hit December of 2015 and he's doing the Muslim ban proposal already, he's like a front runner in the race.
Right.
And so we then it was sort of like really trying to report out with voters what about this was appealing. And I think that became a critical mission in our reporting to sort of there was one conversation happening about Donald Trump in the Acela corridor, and there was a whole other conversation happening out in the country, and it became our mission to make sure we got that.
Yeah, which is a common affliction. You know, Gary Hart back in 1987 told me something that I will never forget, and it was probably the wisest thing anyone's ever told me about sort of politics in our country. He said, just remember, Washington's always the last to get the news. And it was so smart. You know, and yes, something was happening out there.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
You mentioned Jeff Zucker. Mm-hmm. He was a towering presence here. He was the one. He probably brought you over here, mm-hmm. and he brought me here as well. And that's true of many of the people who worked here. He left, as you know, under not optimal circumstances, suddenly and so on. How does an organization that was so centered on the personality and leadership of one individual, how does it evolve from there?
It's a great question, and I think we're watching it before our very eyes. There's no doubt Jeff was so central. I think there was an enormous sense of relief when Chris Licht was named as Jeff's successor from the organization, because it was somebody who did what we do. So it was somebody who is a journalist and produced cable news and was of this world, who was coming in, and somebody with a great reputation as a nice guy and a smart person. But I think just the fact that Zaslav, the head of Warner Brothers Discovery, tapped somebody who did what we do was a really important step. I mean, obviously, if you read the press, so many high profile people in the organization were expressing publicly concerns about Jeff's departure. I think that
you must have felt that yourself.
Without a doubt. I was on paternity leave when it happened, and I was like, my mind was blown. I love Jeff dearly. Mm-hmm. But I do think tapping Chris was something that helped the organization in that very trying moment realize that it may be a transition, but that there was we were going to be on a similar mission.
And to this day, you know, I'm trying to process, David, what's going on right now with these hearings, even as Trump is the Republican frontrunner. And, you know, on the one hand, what we're learning isn't terribly surprising. It's appalling, but it's not surprising, because from the beginning, Trump's whole political project and, frankly, his whole life was predicated on the notion that he was going to flout rules and laws and norms and institutions. He's made a life's practice of that. So the fact that he would do it on the biggest thing is not that surprising. The thing that I think we all missed, and that maybe we're not journalists necessarily, but we have to think more about, is how much of the country believes those rules and laws and norms and institutions are conspiring against them. Mm-hmm. And so by taking them, you know, Trump as rule breaker is actually part of his appeal to people who don't think the rules are working for them, and that the
and that's not only Trump supporters, I think, David, that believe
yes,
that the rules aren't
no
working
doubt.
For them. I think it has that sentiment has a broader audience than just those that support
Donald
Trump
politically.
Listen, we
did a poll for the Institute of Politics recently, and 56% of the people in that poll said they believed that government was corrupt and rigged against people like them. 56%. That's not all Republicans. They indexed high, but there were plenty of Democrats, and 51% of liberal Democrats said that, maybe for some different reasons, some may be the same. That has to do with economics. But I mean, this is a challenge for democracy that transcends Trump. If large numbers of people feel that this project isn't working for them, And I think, you know, we'd be wise to take that lesson from all of this and not just focus on what one man did to exploit and, you know, exacerbate.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I don't know where it is right now, but one of our polls earlier this year, a majority of Americans believed that election officials might change the outcome of an election because of their partisan interests. I mean, that's...
Well, they have a pretty good example of that.
They do, but it, I'm just saying it is widespread.
No,
the sentiment that this is maybe not a totally secure democracy.
In that same poll, we asked, not about the last election, but it was an agree-disagree statement, and it was, you know, I believe our elections are generally... you know, administered fairly and counted accurately. A majority agreed, but only 33% of Republicans agree with that. So that wasn't just about the last election. It was a general statement about elections. And that is a Trump effect. There's no doubt about it. And it may be his greatest negative legacy is to cast doubt on the integrity of the electoral system, which is so fundamental to a democracy. The other thing he cast a doubt on, David, was CNN. Mm. I think he had obvious antipathy to Jeff Zucker, who was at NBC and was the guy who bought and helped develop The Apprentice, mm-hmm. that made Trump the political force that he became. But I think some of it had to do with CNN itself and CNN's positioning in the world. He told Leslie Stahl that he attacked the media because he didn't want people to believe what they were saying. And a lot of people believed, and, you know, many still do. But CNN had a broad swath. It wasn't just of the left or the. And I think he saw that as threatening. And he made it his project to partisanize.
Without a doubt. I mean, he and by the way, I don't think I assume you'll agree with me on this. This was not new to American politics for presidents to try and utilize the press.
Of course.
As an opportunity. I mean, Richard Nixon is the example that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Famously did this. So this there was something tried and true about this. But you are right. Trump wanted clearly to make CNN an actor in his presidency, in the way in which the country perceived him. He wanted us to be an opponent of his. I mean, literally calling us the enemy of the people, which is just, you know,
well,
so
Stalin-esque.
Offensive to. Yeah. And, you know, I think it had some success for him politically at times. I think it did not ultimately succeed for him as like the thing that was going to be able to save him. And I've worked in a lot of newsrooms. I think CNN, for the most part, did a pretty good job of not taking his bait. And what we did instead was sort of double down on our journalistic mission. I mean, at the beginning of the Trump presidency, I saw a rededication to purpose, not just at CNN, but across journalism, mm-hmm. to holding those in power accountable to truth and facts. And it was just, it really redoubled the mission, I think, of journalism in many ways that proved very successful for CNN. I mean, I think it brought in some of the most talented reporters here.
There was a sort of weird symbiosis. I mean, it was good for CNN and good for journalism in the sense that people were paying attention. And Trump said, you guys are going to miss me when I'm gone. And we've seen it. We've seen not just at CNN, but across the board, kind of a decline in interest, which was white hot when he was there. Well, let's talk about where we are now. You just reported out a poll from CNN. Tell me how you see the political climate today.
Well, I mean, obviously, President Biden is in a world of hurt at the moment in terms of the polls. He's at 38% approval in our brand new poll that came out this week. That's his numeric low point of his presidency in our poll. But he's been hovering in those upper 30s, low 40s, low range for a while. I mean, numerically, it actually puts him at the very bottom of the heap of all his modern day predecessors at this point in their presidency, including Donald Trump, who was a point higher in, around this time, 39%. But I think more important than just Biden's numbers, David, this is an electorate. This is a country that is so dissatisfied at the moment. And so I think 21% of voters in our poll said things are going well in the country. We haven't seen the number that low since 2009.
Yes, at the height of the Great
Recession.
Exactly.
And so you're just seeing a sour, dour, dissatisfied electorate out there. And that usually doesn't bode well for the party in power, right? That kind of sentiment. What is interesting, and I think, you know, you and I have studied midterm elections and the correlation between a president's approval and his party's performance in the midterm elections. It's like, it's not quite one-to-one, but it's as like closely correlated in American politics as you can get on any score. And yet what we're seeing in this poll is the generic congressional ballot right now is tied 46% to 46%, Republicans to Democrats, if the election was held today. So the
we should point out that is improvement for Democrats for sure. And we can talk about why in a second. Democrats, because of the way we sort ourselves geographically, generally need 6 to 8 points of margin to actually gain.
To give an example, back in 2014 at around this point, Democrats had a 4-point advantage on the generic congressional ballot. As I recall, 2014 was not a very good year for Democrats. They lost control of the Senate. They lost House seats. And yet they had a 4-point advantage on this. But in 2018, to your point, Democrats had an 8-point advantage on the score at this point. They won 40 seats in the House.
Right.
So, yes, the fact that it's tied gives Republicans comfort. But it does, as you said, Democrats have improved a bit. And it does give Democrats some sense that I'm talking to right now that perhaps this may not be as like monstrous of a loss as they initially thought.
Yes. Instead of a Category 5 storm, it could be a Category 3.
There you go.
Yes. But that Category 3 has implications. It could mean that Democrats hang on to the U.S. Senate, for example. And Trump is actually helping, potentially helping in that project by enlisting candidates for Senate, for governor, in some cases for the House, who have the wherewithal to win primaries, but may be the less effective general election candidate. Pennsylvania, a case in point, where he pushed Dr. Oz across the finish line, but Dr. Oz is deeply unpopular in that state. Herschel Walker in Georgia, you know, may still win that race for a variety of reasons, but he is having a really difficult time. And Warnock, the Democratic incumbent there, Reverend Warnock, is running far ahead of Stacey Abrams, who is running for governor against Brian Kemp. So, you know, I keep saying that the antidote for Democrats, or at least the best thing they have going for, may be him and Republicans, who should, by dint of all these indices that you talked about, should romp in the fall.
Yeah, I mean it is as advantageous a overall climate as one could imagine for Republicans, and again, where people stand on the economy and inflation, it's hard to see all these other pieces necessarily totally eradicating that. I mean, that is still the driving force. You mentioned Trump. I also think the Supreme Court and overturning of Roe versus Wade has no doubt, if you just look at the data.
That's where the turn came.
Yeah, has enthused some Democrats to
I think this is such an important point, because I don't think that I don't think it's just about abortion. I think that's clearly a big animating force. That was such a wrenching turn in social policy in this country back 50 years, and it's enraged not just women but many men. But it also helped support the growing fear among some voters of extremism on the Republican side. So guns, this whole issue of elections. Mm-hmm. Whereas 6 months ago, I think you heard in focus groups, independent voters saying, the Democrats are just, they're too far left, they're too extremes, critical race theory and all of that. Now these same voters are saying, these Republicans are starting to scare me. And I think that's what's pulling this vote back a little. The question is, where will we be in November and whether this trend will continue and whether Republicans can control these forces that have been unleashed?
Right. And to your point about Trump, how much does he really inject himself? I mean, if he really is going to announce a candidacy for the 2024 presidential run prior to the midterms, he's going to be such a dominant
focus.
Well, I
think there are a lot of Democrats who are hoping that that happens.
There's
and
no
a lot
and
of Republicans
are
who are praying
it.
That exactly. It won't. But he, for his own reasons, some of which have to do with his legal predicament, may decide, I'm going to do that. And he tends to do what he wants to do.
The other thing I'll just say about him in these January 6th hearings, there's so much conversation going on right now that he is taking on water, that there's some damage being done within Republican ranks of Donald Trump. And I think there's some evidence to support that. But I feel like the other piece of that that is missing is that that may actually ultimately help Donald Trump. Because what does it mean if he takes on water with Republicans? That he can't clear a field. That Republicans are jumping in. And he benefits
larger
from a
crowded field. Because they have a
winner-take-all
primary system over there.
The way that Republicans do the nomination process. So if there's a crowded field, it'll be like 2015 and 16 all over again. He'll only need 25 or 30% of the vote in a given primary to win all the delegates.
Exactly.
So it's this perverse, like he might be doing some there might be some damage done and he's taking on water with Republicans and that may ultimately help him.
Let's talk about Biden for a second. Obviously, I know him well, served with him. Consider him a friend. But he obviously, as you say, for the last year has been, on a kind of downward scheme. And some of it has to do with issues that are frankly global in nature, inflation, supply chain issues, energy prices that whoever's in charge is going to get blamed for.
That's the job,
no
right?
No matter what. Yeah. Some of it has to do with age. And that's a harder thing to, I mean, those things may resolve themselves. And it has to do with how he presents himself. I'm asking you as the theater guy, how much of that is holding him down? How much of that is creating doubt?
It's a good question, David. I don't know that I've seen a ton of data to support that is. I haven't been witnessing to enough focus groups where that's been
the Times poll
question.
When people were asked whether they want him to run, 64% said no. And of that group, when they were asked why, 33%, the top number was age.
Yeah, that's the only sort of piece I've seen that supports the theory. So I'd want to see more and hear from voters more. It's not like he wasn't old on the campaign trail in 2020, right? And it didn't prevent him, but because of COVID, he wasn't out as much. And so perhaps Americans didn't get to see him as much and make this perception. I think that...
As you know, as you approach 50, the arrow only goes in one direction.
That is true.
Yes.
I do think it's something that he and his team are going to have to address more if indeed he does choose to run. And it's not just about putting out a doctor's report, right? I think he needs to address this issue head on. He's the one that said to the country, he's here to pass the torch to the next generation.
We'll see. Presidents can recover. We were at 38% with Barack Obama in August of 2000, at least in some polls. August of 2011, mm-hmm. Nate Silver wrote a piece on the cover of the New York Times Magazine in November of 2011 saying, is Obama toast? And he ended up winning a pretty healthy electoral landslide. So that can change. But this factor is one that has that Biden's going to have to consider. We could talk about what would happen if he didn't run. But I want to reserve some time to talk about one other thing. You're a gay man.
Mm-hmm.
You're married.
I am.
You have two adorable
thanks
children. Talk to me about that journey, that part of your life.
It was, I mean,
not just the kids, but just as a young man.
Yeah.
How
I came out very late in life, so it was something that
why.
I guess because I was trying desperately not to have to admit to myself that I am not fitting the image that I think I had or my family had or my friends had for me in my life.
That's painful.
Yeah, no doubt.
And must have been lonely.
It was. And yet I had a fantastic childhood and like very happy and very surrounded by love and support and it was not the pain was lonely, it wasn't something I wallowed in. It wasn't something that diminished my ability to love life, which I always have. It was diminishing my ability to live my life to the fullest. And when that became untenable for me, this was in my late 30s.
Mm.
So you know, I would just. And it's so, when I think about it now, it's like, I came from the most supportive environment of this. Nobody in my family or friend circle would have been at all upset, or it wouldn't have rocked their world in a way. But I couldn't get there. I just couldn't get there. So
if David Chalian were born today.
Yeah.
Do you think you would have less have had less of a struggle? I was struck by the fact that the House overwhelmingly this week voted to codify gay marriage and to do away with the Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed in the 90s, that was really hostile to gay marriage. And there were 47 Republicans who voted for it. Are we in a time where young
people— Some in leadership, like yes. Elise Stefanik.
Yeah. Are we at a time where young people will feel less conflicted?
I think so. I mean, the one thing I recall just covering this issue as a journalist, I had never seen public opinion move
I couldn't agree more.
As fast on this issue. And I'll tell you a story. I was at an off-the-record lunch in 2009. I believe you may have been there, but I was seated next to Robert Gibbs, and it was like ABC's political Washington yeah. team and the White House team. And I was sitting next to your friend and colleague, Robert Gibbs, and I turned to him and I said, I'm going to make you a bet right now. I'm going to bet you that Barack Obama runs as a pro-gay marriage presidential candidate for re-election in 2012. And he turned to me in the winter of 2009 and said, not a chance.
Yeah. It's funny.
You know,
I'll tell you a story. In 2011, when we were meeting to discuss the campaign, he said, sometime during this campaign, someone's going to ask me a direct question about gay marriage. And I'm telling all you guys how I'm going to answer. And you better figure out how you're going to deal with it. So, you know, this was always
having
a troubling
Joe Biden
issue
go on Meet the Press was not one of the options.
No, but he was. So that was long before Joe Biden went on Meet the Press.
Yeah.
But he struggled with this because I can tell you way back to when he was running for the Senate, he was struggling with this because he had gay friends and gay neighbors. And this was not, you know, he was not fearful about gay marriage. Let me ask you just in closing a couple of things about that. You are happily married now,
mm-hmm.
and
as
I mentioned,
5 years. Did,
yeah, which is great. What did you think when you read Clarence Thomas's opinion in the Dobbs Dobbs decision on abortion, in which he said, now we ought to take a look at gay marriage, we ought to take a look at contraception, and so on. I mean, is there any?
I know this is going to be so hard for people listening to this to believe, or they'll think I'm dead inside. I don't know. I read Clarence Thomas's concurrence like as part of my job. It doesn't go through some filter of what does that mean for me and my life? And I'm one of those journalists, David, I don't vote. Okay. Because I don't think you can be a journalist and vote. I think you can do both things. For me personally, and this came from people like Charlie Gibson and others that I worked with at ABC, I got to participate in a different way. I got to poke and prod and be in Iowa and be in New Hampshire and ask questions and test the thesis of politicians and what have you. And it felt like I didn't have to go in then and make a choice between these people I cover, right?
So you have the ability to separate that.
It's this thing. It's like, yeah, so I see that and I don't go to the place in my mind of like, oh, wait, I'm a man married to a man. And now a member of the United States Supreme Court is saying that, you know, it didn't filter
well,
through
put it
to me
way.
In that way.
Do you have any fear or concern that somehow we'll go backwards on this issue?
I don't. Maybe I'm naive. I think what we were just talking about, the speed with which the American people
There's
moved on
There's a huge
on
majority
it,
on it.
It's so big. It's hard not to. I mean, the vote you cited last night would have been unthinkable.
Yeah.
And I just think the issue has moved to a place of permanence. I am sure people are listening and being like, yeah, I thought that about Roe v. Wade. And maybe if the Republicans form some 50-year-long quest to overturn gay marriage and organize around it in the way they did on the abortion issue, public opinion can be changed again and things can move again. I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, yeah. David Chalian, happy birthday.
Thanks,
thank you
man.
For spending part of it with me, and thanks for being such a great colleague. I always, always enjoy chatting with you and listening to you.
Right back at you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.